Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We're going to have four bills today for public hearing and possible work session. What we're going to do is we're going to start off with the House Bill 2361. Since we have all the witnesses here, the others are going to be either phone-in or other presentations. So open the work session on House Bill.
Public hearing,
on House Bill 2361A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2361A eliminates the culpable mental state requirement for administrative sanctions against liquor licensees and service permit holders that allow on-premises consumption of alcohol by minors or visibly intoxicated persons.
All right. Now, I have three individuals that are listed here to testify: Bill Perry, Linda Ignoski, and Eugene Tisch. If y'all want to please come forward, please. And I'm not sure who wants to start, Bill.
I started last time, so I'll start this time, I guess.
Alrighty.
For the record, Bill Perry, the Oregon Restaurant Restaurant Lodging Association. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 2361 is a product of an interim work group that was called by Representative Schaffler and Representative Barker. And there was, as I get into the description, I'll get down on the Angros Bill, line 22, starting there. But there was a specific case where there was a bar, I think it was up in East Multnomah County, where they had a lot of reports of drunk drivers leaving. And so this was trying to address that specific issue. And so what we did on the House side was the original G under the statute, they were talking about potentially removing the knowingly. But remember, serving underage, so if you're under the age of 21, is a pretty definite standard. And so it's easier to prove. But when you're talking about visibly intoxicated, obviously I would term it as an arbitrary standard, and then adding knowingly to that makes it kind of two arbitrary standards. And so what we did in that paragraph was we split it in half. And so G just deals with sales. So it deals with sales to minors, but it also deals to sales with visibly intoxicated. Now, the significance there is, remember, a sale can happen either on an on- or off-premise. So grocery stores would be included by if you deal with the sale of visibly intoxicated. But then when you separate G out and remove the or H out and remove the knowingly, you deal with consumption, then you just deal with on-premise establishments. So we figured this was a little bit more targeted, so you don't bring in a lot of other opposition in the grocery stores, wineries, and some of those things, but it gets at the problem of trying to figure out a way to get how to get some more of these letters of reprimand to stick to people that have a high level of Dewey reports. So with that, I'll let the other people go and answer questions.
Okay. Whoever would like to go next, if you give us your name first.
All right. Chairman Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Eugene Tisch, and good morning. I am an active member of the Oregon State Bar, but I am not engaged in private practice. I am not here representing anyone but myself. My wife and I own the Garibaldi House Inn. It's a higher-end 50-room internal corridor hotel on the Oregon coast that we operate as a bed and breakfast. That entity is a member of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, but again, I am not here representing that organization. We are not licensed for the service of alcohol, but we do not discourage patrons from bringing alcohol into our premises for enjoyment while they're there. We sit across Garibaldi Avenue, which is Highway 101, from two licensed bars, one of which is, I believe, more responsible in their service of alcohol. The other, in my opinion, is highly irresponsible in the service of alcohol. Unfortunately, there is no mystery as to which one appears to be the most successful. Every weekend and many nights, we watch and hear heavily intoxicated patrons stagger out of the bar and into their cars to drive away in the early morning hours with squealing tires, roaring motors. Frequently, we see them attempt to cross Highway 101. Some have virtually crawled, as we have watched that, back to our hotel, or worse yet, to come over to our side of Highway 101 to get behind the wheel of their car and drive away. One of the many interesting occurrences last year was one evening when one of those bars called and indicated that a guest of our hotel had consumed alcohol to the point of passing out, and they asked if we would come and get them. We declined, but soon saw two representatives of that bar carrying the patron into our lobby. Holding a liquor license is a privilege granted by the state. It's not a right, and with that privilege, we feel there should be a high level of responsibility. While that may not give rise to a fiduciary obligation, it should at least give rise to a high level of responsibility for due care in regard to the person being served, and perhaps more importantly for others that could be predictably negatively impacted by the person being served. Alcohol is a mind-altering drug. That's why I personally enjoy responsible use of alcohol. But in an alcohol service environment, it is imperative that licensees be held to a high standard of diligence in regard to the condition of the person being served. Current law, with the burden on the state to prove that the server licensee knew that the person being served was visibly intoxicated, effectively allows the server licensee protection to continue promoting and encouraging consumption until the person being served is beyond the ability to reason and or to function normally. An OLCC field representative that works in the Portland area confided a few months ago that, in their opinion, most bars overserve as a standard business practice. The culpable mental state requirement currently in ORS 471315 and ORS 471412 makes it nearly impossible for law enforcement to impact this issue at the source. Too often in our society, we focus on putting an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff instead of a fence at the top. While policing activity to arrest drunk drivers is important, action to reduce the percentage of bar patrons that leave the bar seriously impaired is far more cost-effective and probably more effective overall. In many small rural towns and coastal towns, similar to where my business is located, policing activity is almost non-existent, especially in the early morning hours. Action to control flagrant overserving, again too often a standard business practice, is vitally important in the control of antisocial activity and impaired driving. Both of these can cause great harm to innocent people, too often defenseless children. Oregon needs to strive for a more responsible level of alcohol service. I want to express appreciation for the time and effort many legislators, government officials, and industry representatives that have worked since the last session to get this bill to where it is today. I encourage you to continue to support this bill and help it become law in Oregon. The lives of many innocent Oregonians may be dependent on your decision. I would be happy to answer any questions. Right. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you. Before we do any questions, Linda?
Good morning. Good morning, Chairman Pozanski, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Linda Ignowski. I'm the Regulatory Services Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission supports House Bill 2361, which amends ORS 471315 and 471412. By eliminating the knowingly element in the prohibition against licensees and permittees, will make a great difference in the lives of many Oregonians in the state. It's directly linked to saving lives. Oregon experiencing still about 25,000 DUI arrests a year. We're still experiencing 179 alcohol-related deaths through crashes based on alcohol. This is not including the injuries that happen at licensed premises from fights and for disorderly conduct. This is not about the majority of our licensees. Most of our licensees are responsible servers and sellers of alcohol. This is not about making it easier for OLCC or the law enforcement to cite people. This is not about making it canceling people's licenses. This is about trying to save lives and creating a reasonable standard for licensees when they are serving alcohol to their patrons. This bill will help address those servers who choose to ignore the law and allowing the patrons to continue to consume when they are clearly visibly intoxicated and should be stopped from consuming any more alcohol. This bill will also help licensees in hopefully losing their licenses and from keeping people from being over-intoxicated and causing fights and disturbances at their licensed premises. We support this bill. We hope that you'll pass this. It's an important bill for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Open up for questions. I guess the question I have, based on Eugene's, your testimony, I'm assuming that you brought to the attention OLCC regarding this one establishment that seems to, let's say, overserve.
That is correct.
And has there been any action that you know of, or can anyone tell me whether there's been any enforcement action against that particular establishment?
They have begun greater activity at the area. We're a long way away. And under the current legislation, you know, the standard's fairly high in terms of what they have to experience or witness at that time. But I feel comfortable that it is being addressed more aggressively.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2361A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 2361. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2361.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2361A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 2360.
House Bill.
House Bill 2361A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions or comments? Objections? So ordered. And let's see, Chair will carry 2361 to the floor. Close the work session on 2361. And I think we're going to do a telephone call for the next bill. And that is going to be 2849. I want to see if there's anyone else. There's no one else. So at this point, I'll go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 2849. And Drew, why don't you go ahead and go through the summary.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2849 increases the penalty for a crime of criminal mistreatment in the first degree to a Class B felony if the victim is 65 years of age or older.
And so we're ready to go, so I'll go ahead and turn this on. Okay. Good morning. Are we supposed to be connected?
Yeah.
All right, Laura Lee. Oh,
thank you.
Good morning. Hang on.
Chairman Persanky, a member for the committee. My name is Laura Lee Carlson, and I requested this bill because of some cases of substantiated abuse that happened to my mother when she resided in a residential care home from January 21st, 2001 to November 21st, 2005, and an adult care home from November 21st, 2005 to November 30th, 2007. The only thing that happened to these homes for abusing my mother were letters basically saying, don't do this again, and sanctions were never imposed. In addition, there were other allegations of abuse which protective services had difficulty substantiating, in part because my mother had Alzheimer's disease and could not tell them or answer their questions. One of the most serious incidents happened August 10, 2005. Just prior to this, August 5, 2005, my daughter and I visited my mother at the residential care home. I commented to the caregiver that my mother did not look well. The bathroom had a strong urine smell, and she was using more Depends. I was told my mother was just getting old and tired, going to bed earlier, getting up later, and running a low-grade fever. The home's owner caregiver, a registered nurse, also had been commenting to me a few times prior to this, was I prepared for my mother to die? Then on August 10th, my mother had a scheduled doctor's appointment. I had informed the home of the date and time and followed it up with a telephone call the day of the appointment. No one answered the telephone, so I left a message.
I requested that someone call me back to confirm they had gotten the message. There was no call back. My husband and I went to the home at the scheduled time we said we would be there to pick her up. We found my mom unresponsive and in bed. We asked the caregiver on duty, the owner's husband, why no one had called us back and why no one had informed us that something was wrong with my mother. There was no comment. We called my mother's doctor and were told to call 911. When we told the owner's husband caregiver that we called 911, he questioned why we had done this. My mother was transported by ambulance to a hospital where she was diagnosed with a very serious urinary tract infection and dehydration. If we had not discovered my mother's condition and taken action, she would have died. And I would have believed the care home's owner, a registered nurse, that my mother had died of old age, which would not have been true. Because I advocated for my mother, the home's owner became vindictive toward me. The findings of abuse by Protective Services were sent to the home October 11, 2005 and February 15, 2006. Following all of this, the state's client care monitoring survey visit for the home was on May 22, 2006, when the home was found to be in substantial noncompliance, which was outlined in a 31-page report. And while the survey team was there, a resident was found to be in immediate danger. This should have never happened since the home had been notified just before this about the findings of substantiated abuse of my mother. If we had House Bill 2849 at that time and sanctions had been imposed, residents in this care home would not have been abused. Following this, I placed my mother in an adult care home facility November 21, 2005 to November 30, 2007. Prior to placing her there, I visited the facility and then checked the records with Clackamas County Adult Care Home Licensing. At that time, the home had a perfect record. However, I did not know the home had problems in Multnomah County prior to it moving to Clackamas County. At that time, care home records did not follow them from county to county, and thus the care home had a clean record. Also, the care home's owner told me she was a CNA, which was also on her business card. At first, my mother's care in the adult care home appeared to be very good. Then things started to deteriorate. On a visit to her oncologist, the doctor discovered her cancerous breast had been severely palpitated and bruised. He issued a stern written warning to the caregiver to never do this again. Meanwhile, my mother was put on hospice. During the hospice nurse's visits, the nurse found my mother's body had numerous bruises all over it in the shape of handprints. The owner caregiver required hospice nurse to make an appointment before coming to see my mother, which really sent up the red flags. This is never to happen according to adult care home regulations. Hospice is to have patient access 24/7 without having to make an appointment. The owner caregiver was not on site during some of my visits to see my mother, thus leaving the elderly residents home alone. This was reported to Protective Services and it was substantiated. However, there were no sanctions imposed. I also observed a caregiver slamming a resident into a chair and yelling at her, "Eat, eat, eat." She would also quite often yell at my mother. The care home's owner caregiver had me paying $100 a month for incontinence supplies in addition to having me supply them and also having hospice bring them. The hospice nurse and myself found the supplies stockpiled under my mother's bed. When this was brought up to the care home owner, caregiver, she became explosive. It appeared to me that she was trying to extort money and supplies from us. Then she gave me an undated letter asking for an additional $300 a month for feeding and turning my mother in bed at night. This was not the truth, as my mother was able to do these things herself. The care home owner caregiver fired the hospice bath aide, which was something she was not supposed to do. She said she did this because the aide backed into her driveway. When my mother was ordered by her physician to have bed baths, she was given a tub bath by the homeowner caregiver. An incident happened in the bathtub, and she was badly bruised and shaken. One day, I went to visit my mother at 10 a.m. on a Saturday, and the residents had not even been given their breakfast. The caregiver's excuse was, kind of my day day off. These are a few of the examples of abuse my mother suffered in these two homes. Following this, I moved my mother to a new care home where she became full of smiles and repeated many times, thank you, thank you, thank you. I was so pleased that she was last in a loving home with wonderful care. This is where she spent the last days of her life. After I moved my mother to the new care home, I learned the previous adult care home owner, caregiver, was not a CNA. At that time, the Oregon State Board of Nursing did not have a regulation regarding CNA imposters. However, it issued a very strongly worded letter to the CNA imposter. Had I known this person had gotten into trouble in Multnomah County and lied about being a CNA, I would have never, ever left my mother in this home. If we had House Bill 2849, things like this may have been prevented. People in the care home business would know they were going to be dealt with if they abused our elderly loved ones. They need to be held accountable for their actions. It seems that if an elderly person is abused, nothing happens. If a child or a pet is abused, it is front page news. And my mother was just one of many vulnerable elderly persons who may have been abused in these homes. There's never a single day in my life that I don't think about the abuse that my mother suffered, despite my very best efforts to keep her from harm's way. I checked the public files of these homes before placing her in them. I constantly visited her. However, these people are really experts in knowing how to fly right under the radar and not get caught. Current sanctions are just the cost of doing business if ever imposed and are nothing to these people who make huge sums of money operating care homes. This bill has been my goal for approximately 5 years. We need to protect our elderly loved ones. Thank you for listening to my story, and please give your nod of approval to HB 2849.
Ms. Carlson, thank you very much for your testimony. At this point, let me see if there's any questions from anyone on the panel. I'm not seeing anyone with any questions. I want to thank you for your time and see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2849. We don't have anyone coming forward, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2849. Ms. Carlson, again, thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to go ahead and discontinue our connection with you unless you had any other questions.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so Brad, you're here on 2828. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2828A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2828A creates an unlawful employment practice if employer interrupts employee insurance when employee is scheduled for or attends jury service. It creates an unlawful employment practice if employer discharges, threatens to discharge, intimidates, or coerces an employee by reason of employee's service or scheduled service as juror. Permits employee to bring civil claim or file a complaint with the Bureau of Labor and Industries in either case. Authorizes a court to assess a civil penalty in the amount of $720 for a violation of the latter unlawful employment practice.
Brad?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt, House District 31, appearing before you this morning in support of House Bill 2828A. This is quite simply a bill that preserves insurance companies or insurance coverage, for those employees who so choose when they are called to jury service. The best example that I could give you of what this bill tries to address would be the instance where a part-time employee is working, let's say, 20 hours a week. Typically, health insurers require in the neighborhood of 80 hours in a month as a threshold in order to qualify for health insurance coverage. That employee is called to jury service and fails to receive the requisite 80 hours in a month in order to qualify for that insurance. This bill covers employers with 10 or more employees and for those employees who continue to elect that coverage. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and with that, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions that your committee might have.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Representative Witt. Senator Cruz first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I obviously you must have some examples of where this has happened, because I can't imagine in most cases where an employer would be punitive in this way.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, it's not. It's typically not that an employer is being punitive. The usual circumstances would be that the insurance company just requires X number of hours in order to qualify, and that's a requirement of the insurance company. It's typically not a choice of the employer. It's not a choice of the employee. It's just the way things run with the individual insurance plan.
All right. Hang on one second. Anything else?
Well, I'm just trying to think. I mean, for my employees that I cover, they're full time employees. That's my criteria. And I'm just trying to understand a situation where if they had to spend a week on jury duty, they suddenly wouldn't qualify because it's full time over a broader period than a month. Our definition is seasonal, non seasonal as well. So
yes. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, again, this would impact or tend to impact part-time employees who are closer to that threshold than would full-time employees.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Witt, for bringing this bill forward. And I'm looking out, and I don't see the insurance companies here. Did they show up in the House side and oppose this, or were they supportive, or is it just so narrow that they didn't weigh in on the issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonamici, this is this bill actually impacts a relatively few number of employees, and while I certainly don't speak for them, would suspect that the number of cases is de minimis, and there's has not appeared to be a whole lot of concern about this.
Other Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, if it's really the insurer that is not providing, that doesn't provide coverage if you don't have a minimum number of hours of working, then, and the employer has such a policy, how would the employer comply?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Witsit, what would then occur, the employer would presumably make, in the instance where it's hourly contributions, that's typically, again, what happens, there would be contributions that would be made on behalf of that employee for the number of hours that that either he or she is on jury service up to, again, presumably, that that minimum threshold. You're welcome.
Any other questions or comments? Brad, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2828A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 2828A. And are you ready for a work session? Let's go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2828A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2828A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2828A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Bonamici, will you be our carry on this
yes,
one?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2828A. And we'll open up our last public hearing for the day, House Bill 3558A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 3558A applies statutory choice of law rules to certain commercial contracts involving a financial institution, provides that those rules apply to all existing contracts except those contracts subject to civil action or arbitration, declares emergency, and is effective upon passage.
All right. Paul, why don't you come on up? Is there going to be anyone else who will want to give testimony today on 3558A.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Bankers and the American Insurance Association. Mr. Fogg from Perkins Coie joined me on the Senate side, and I sort of expected him to be here today, but I'm happy to try to carry the water on this bill. 10 years ago, I participated in a work group convened by then Representative Lane Shetterly with members including retired Chief Justice Hans Lindy and a number of law school deans and interested parties. And the goal of it was to deal with an Oregon Law Commission bill where the commission was proposing that we codify in Oregon the rules that have been developed by the courts over the years for how to choose which state's law applies in certain kinds of cases. In some cases, the laws of the various states of the various parties involved in a lawsuit are different from each other, and in some cases, the parties haven't chosen which law they would like to apply in if they have a dispute. And so these rules have developed over the years. The bill was passed in 2001, took effect in January 2002, and I know this is going to shock you, but we actually found out that we hadn't drafted it properly, although it took us 10 years to figure that out, and that's why we're back here with House Bill 3558. And the error that has existed for the last 10 years, which does not conform to what our intent was when we drafted it, we wanted it to make clear that if the parties had chosen which law would apply if they had a dispute, that that choice would be honored by an Oregon court. And there was a technical error in the drafting of how we made the applicability of the provisions that wasn't absolutely clear. And Mr. Fogg from Perkins Coie works with lots of big commercial transactions in which, amongst the other legal opinions that are often required by lawyers in those transactions, is an opinion on which state's law applies to this agreement. And he was having, and others of his colleagues in other law firms were having difficulty with that because of the drafting error back in 2001. So he brought House Bill 3558. We worked it to make sure it was hopefully this time crystal clear, and I think it passed through the House with no opposition, and we would hope that you would consider passing it on to the Senate floor with your due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici first.
No, George Fogg isn't here, but his son Nick is. Are you here to testify?
All right, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. This bill confuses me. Because Section 2, Sub 1 talks about is retroactive, and yet Section 2 is not. Explain what this is doing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, because it was our intent in 2001 to allow parties to choose the law and make it that choice effective, the Legislative Council has drafted these sections 2 and 3 in a way that they believe makes this retroactive back to 2001, so that if the parties had chosen in their contracts to apply Oregon law or Washington law or New York law or Delaware law, whatever law they chose, that this would make that effective, even though we're clarifying the law 10 years later. The Section 2 Sub 1 says it applies to all contracts regardless of when entered into. Remember, this is making it so that their choices are effective. Subsection 2 says it cannot apply in a pending case in arbitration, because there may be cases already where this issue has been raised and briefed by the parties, and we didn't want, Legislative Council thought it unwise to affect those cases. But if there hasn't been a dispute, it will apply retroactively. And Senator Cruz, my understanding, and I wasn't involved in the specific choice of these two sections, subsections here, but that is, in my understanding, what Legislative Council proposes is the best way to handle issues like this in other contexts as well.
I guess, and I thank you for the explanation, Ms. Chair. Thank you very much. So basically, it goes back to 2001 but if there's ongoing, so it's retroactive to all those things that are closed, and not retroactive for those in dispute.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, it's retroactive for all matters that where there's no dispute that has yet arisen, but if it's in a court or arbitration proceeding right now where a dispute is before a decider of fact, then it's not retroactive. It allows that court to make that decision or that arbitrator to make that decision.
Right. So basically, it looks back and tries to correct the problem that was an oversight, but understanding that those contracts that could be in dispute that are either in the courts now or through some type of arbitration or mediation, whatever the type of alternative dispute settlement, those would not be impacted by the bill because they're ongoing under whatever is being challenged in the forum.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove, this, is my understanding, applies to commercial contracts but not consumer contracts, or is
Mr.
That
Chair, Senator Bonamici, that's correct. The problem arose because of us failing to make it clear that the statutory rules other than this in general apply to commercial contracts, and that's where the problem is, and that's the problem that's being addressed here. And just to add into that, in some kinds of commercial contracts, the typical sale of goods across state lines, it's what we call the battle of the forms. One party says, here's my invoice, and I'm going to apply Oregon law, and the other party says, we accept it, and we're going to apply this subject to Virginia law. Those are the kinds of conflicts of laws to which these statutory provisions give the courts an answer of how to choose which law to apply if there's a difference between those two states' laws.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
One last chance. Anyone want to testify on House Bill 3558A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. And I will go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3558A.
Mr. Chair, because I don't want to try to figure this out anymore, I move House Bill 3558A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
So Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3558A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
No, Mr. Chair, I just want to, in abundance of caution, declare a potential conflict of interest in that my husband is a partner at Perkins Coie, and since that name was raised as a proponent of the bill, just want to put that potential conflict on the record.
All right. Any other conflicts or other questions, comments? Any objections to the motion that's before us? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, was that saying that you wanted to carry the bill on the floor or not?
Sure.
Which any?
I think I can confuse everybody in 30 seconds on this.
All right. So Senator Cruz will be our carrier on House Bill 3558A. And that will close the work session on that bill. And I believe we are completed for today's work of what we're going to do today. Tomorrow, we are scheduled, I think, to start at 8:45. Is that correct, Katie? So 8:45, we will, the goal at this point is to continue with the testimony that we carried over from last Thursday with those who had already signed up. This will not be to take new testimony in the sense of new people coming in, but only to accommodate those who were not able to be heard on Thursday. And then we have a couple other bills that have already been scheduled for Tuesday as well. So with that, we're adjourned until tomorrow at 8:45.